John Rourke was reminded of the collection of buildings in a muddy middle of nowhere that was the motion picture setting for Jack Schaefer's superb novel, Shane. Marianne's home was not a town, but rather an outpost of humanity, and barely that. A few buildings, seven in all, almost stared each other down across a wide empty street that was like a gulf between them. Rather than mud, there was snow, and although there was no vehicular traffic in the snow, there were hoofprints of shod horses.
I see them!
Rourke stopped walking. He stood about 50 yards from the nearest building.
Marianne?
Yeah?
Who lives here? A father and a mother, a husband?
My old man.
Is your old man your father or your husband?
My old man.
I assume you'll go in from the front. Why don't I circle behind the buildings just in case?
Right.
Rourke touched Marianne's elbow and she started ahead, toward the wide street and the seven buildings. If her old man were neither father nor husband, then what was he? John Rourke was already cold, but he removed the glove from his right hand as he started to walk, then the glove from his left. The German assault rifle Natalia carried was reminiscent to her of the short M16, the XM77. The barrel of the German rifle was 12 inches in length, the buttstock collapsible. It fired a modern caseless rifle cartridge, but the overall dimensions were more submachine gun-like in proportion. The stock of the rifle extended, Natalia Anastasia Tyamarovna moved along the scrub brush toward the rear faces of the four buildings on the north side of the street. As difficult as it was for her to comprehend, the rear of the structures were even uglier than the front faces, it appeared. She was as close as she could get to the nearest of the buildings, which might be some sort of livery stable. There was a corral behind it, but no animals were in evidence. She started running, favoring the straight line as the shortest distance between two points theory rather than the zigzagging pattern. She had always been a fast runner, usually able to outlast and outdistance most of the men she'd known. But Michael could outrun her. She liked that. And she thought of Michael Rourke now. She was in love with him, totally. At first, that had frightened her, confused her. And she understood the almost slavish manner in which Michael's dead wife, Madison, had treated him, the same way his longtime mistress, Maria Lloyden, had behaved. There was something about Michael that made a woman want to yield to him. She was afraid for him now, afraid that the terrible risk he took pretending to be Martin Zimmer might cost him his life. And she was afraid for herself as well, because she would be desolate if he left her. He was his father's son, but he was unique unto himself. Where John was reserved, Michael was wild. She realized that if she had somehow been John Rourke's lover before the night of the war, he might have been like that. Both men had endured the terror and death, but Michael, unlike herself or John, was perfectly innocent of any of its cause. And perhaps that was the difference. She reached the rear wall of the building. It definitely was a livery stable. There was smoke filtering through between the slats, likely from a cook stove or something similar. And with the smoke came the smell of manure. There was an almost religious quality to the guilt she felt, which she knew John felt too. To a lesser degree, Paul also felt it. Unlike Annie and Michael, who were children of the night of the war, she and John had been part of the opposing forces that had brought the war about. And Paul, although not in what was euphemistically called the game by some, was on the sidelines, as was every adult in the world. If one didn't try to prevent the unthinkable from occurring, then one was part of the reason that it did occur. If she and John were guilty of sins of commission, then Paul felt himself guilty of sins of omission. In this world, there were only four people who could have that guilt, and one of those was Sarah Rourke. If John was right, and there was a God, then why was Sarah Rourke on the edge of death? Natalia closed her eyes for an instant, then opened them. Michael had made her feel alive again, and she did not want to lose him, lose that. Michael Rourke cursed his lack of formal education. He knew so little about computers, beyond the comparatively simple machine at the retreat, that he could do no more than turn on Martin Zimmer's unit. He could not access any of the files.
Damn it!
Inside that computer will almost certainly be information concerning Dr. Dietrich Zimmer. And Dietrich Zimmer could well hold Michael's mother's life in his hands. Michael Rourke left the desk with its computer console and walked along the near wall of Martin Zimmer's almost ridiculously spacious office. The only thing that pointed to Zimmer's Nazi leanings was a small brass globe, or maybe it was gold, which was placed on a shelf in the large bookcase before which Michael Rourke now stood. Atop the globe was a small, almost meticulously delicate swastika. The building at the rear end of the four structures was a livery stable. The building beside it seemed to be some sort of public house. Marianne, bolder up until now, cowered by the low, wide doorway.
What's the matter?
My old man will be in there.
Oh, don't you want to see him?
Yeah, but...
The unfinished sentence hung there in the air between them, and John Rourke suddenly understood. Sarah or Annie or Natalia would have read the reaction an instant sooner, he realized. She was afraid of her old man, that somehow he would punish her for being gone. John Rourke turned the knob on the cast-iron handle of the door. The unmistakable smells of marijuana and green beer assailed his nostrils, mingling on the cold air with the animal odors from the stable next door. John Rourke went through the doorway first. Michael Rourke walked along the corridor of the Capitol building's first floor toward the staircase at its far end. Gunther Hong walked beside him.
I will show you, Martin, where our search teams are. The transponder signals on the situation map indicate the Rourke family must be boxed in. We were able to field an SS search and destroy team. I thought they needed the practice.
Wise decision.
Instead of getting away, he was going deeper into Martin Zimmer's seat of government. The building itself reminded him of hazy childhood memories and photographs he had seen of classic small-town courthouses. They reached the staircase and started downward. Natalia Tyomarovna stopped moving. Her mind raced. The Germans had maintained a controlled population of dogs a century ago. There was no reason to suppose... She turned her head very slowly. The Chinese of the Second City had kept wolves. Mouth dripping saliva from bared fangs, hind legs flexed. A descendant, presumably, of one of those wolves stood behind her.
Paul, they're too tired to go on.
I know.
Paul looked at Martin Zimmer's face. Martin was obviously cold and otherwise uncomfortable.
You keep laughing, buddy, and you won't have to worry about your father or your brother looking like you anymore. They'll have faces and teeth.
Martin Zimmer's smile disappeared.
I'll get them together.
Don't let any of them get too comfortable. We might have to move out fast.
The configuration of the terrain here was unrelieved flatness. If they were spotted from the air or pursued by a fast vehicle, there would be no place to hide, and it would be a standoff at best, with Martin Zimmer as the sole bargaining chip. And to produce him might be sealing Michael's death, but the women were exhausted.
Bring her over here. Come on.
Zimmer didn't even nod, but turned toward the gathering knot of 22 freed women, the 23rd one on the litter Paul and Martin carried between them. The map of the wildlands dominated an entire wall, but it was only a computer screen. As Michael watched, he was able to discern the exact positions of the ground patrol sent out, he had hoped erroneously, after his family. But one of the patrols was far from the others, on the western side of the Rift Valley.
That is the SS?
Yes, Martin.
Why are they covering the wrong side of the valley?
It was only thought to be good sense in case the Rourke family attempted to trick us all by fleeing in the opposite direction.
And why would a man as clever as John Rourke do something like that? Well?
I can recall them if you wish, Martin.
How many men in all?
15, 12 SS and 3 land pirates.
Scum. No, let them waste their time then.
Michael Rourke prayed they would be doing just that. Natalia had several possible solutions to her immediate dilemma. She merely had to fire a gun and kill the creature. But if she did so with an ordinary gun, the shot or shots would be heard by anyone who might be inside the building behind which she now stood, statue-like, or inside the livery stable, or for that matter, anywhere within the 7-building town. Even using her PPKS with the suppressor would elicit yelps of pain from the animal. The same could be said if she used her knife.
Shit.
There was nothing to do but wait and hope the wolf did the same. John Rourke held open the door just long enough for the terrified Marianne to follow him inside. Because of their natural light sensitivity, his eyes adjusted quickly to the darkness within. A crude lamp burned on either side of a large room, with rough-hewn wooden clapboard walls and erratically spaced support posts running between floor and ceiling. There was a fire burning in the stone hearth that dominated the far wall, and a cast-iron stove, black as night, was at the center of the room. Along the wall to his right was a bar of sorts, just a long table with a few men leaning against it, a few glasses near them, and a few bottles of mixed sizes on a narrow counter behind it. There were several tables scattered indiscriminately about the room, a few more men sitting in small groups at two of them. Several of the men looked toward the doorway.
I have a girl named Marianne with me. She's related to somebody around here.
Related! Related!
John Rourke looked toward the bar. One of the men leaning against it had spoken. He wore several layers of ragged clothing, all of it appearing filthy. Rourke noticed the butt of a pistol. At the distance, it looked like a Beretta 92F, thrusting up from the waistband of baggy trousers, which were bound together with a length of frayed rope that looked nearly black.
Ivan's my old man, mister. We ain't related none.
Rourke didn't look at Marianne as she spoke, but he nodded that he heard her.
There be Ivan.
Her right hand passed the edge of Rourke's peripheral vision, and his eyes followed in the direction she pointed. A big man, but young, sitting at one of the tables with two other men, seemed to be her old man, Ivan.
My friends and I found Marianne a prisoner of the land pirate. My name's John Rourke. And I'm fucking George Washington. Yesterday I was landing, and tomorrow I'm gonna be Lady Godiva.
John Rourke stood where he was, saying nothing.
Now get your ass over here, bitch!
Marianne scurried across the room to him, dropped to her knees at his feet, and made to put her head on his thigh. He kicked her away. Ivan stood up. He was one of the largest human beings John Rourke had ever seen.
Them's nice-looking guns you got. Gimme them, and maybe you walk out of here.
John Rourke was taking a slow step left so the door wouldn't be directly behind him, but there would be a solid wall instead.
We are being pursued by the Eden Armed Forces and the Land Pirates. We have a lot of people in need of shelter from the cold. I need to borrow a horse, unless you got a vehicle that runs. There's a lot of us, and just one of you. Give me them guns.
Get into them, you hear?
There were 10 men, counting the bartender. Allied intelligence indicated that these sub-miniature towns were occasionally nothing more than a den of thieves and killers. The usual armament was material scavenged from the battlefields following the conclusion of hostilities with the Soviets over a century ago, along with some old weapons from the original Eden stores, which dated back 5 centuries before that. The Beretta worn by the man at the bar was one such item, the military pistol of the pre-war United States Armed Forces. And John Rourke smiled as he thought of it. Before the night of the war, he'd known innumerable people in the firearms trade, Beretta personnel among them. They would have been proud to know that 6 centuries after manufacture, their products were still in use. Michael himself carried 2 of them. John Rourke's own guns were more than 6 centuries old, too, and he had no intention of parting with them.
I didn't come here for trouble. I am John Rourke, but your acceptance of that as fact is immaterial at the moment. As to my guns, well, all you'll get of them is the lead part. So let it alone and tell me how I can get hold of a horse and treat the woman decently. Y'all boys spread out now, hear?
John Rourke didn't budge. They were more scavenged weapons, some things that even looked homemade. During the 20th century, a substantial and highly vocal minority had fought unceasingly for what they called gun control, really people control instead. Chief among their spurious arguments was that by some mystical method, the denial of availability of firearms to the law-abiding would prevent criminal misuse. A handmade shotgun or zip gun made from pipe or radio antenna or other available materials was as deadly as the finest weapon ever made. And anyone could make one, even churls such as these. Guns were never a problem, just a relatively minuscule percentage of the people who used them. The bartender had an assault rifle, a wartime AKM-96 of the sort the Russians had used in their fight against Midway. John Rourke hadn't done this sort of thing since that war, when he'd measured his reflex time against equipment in New Germany shortly after this. Awakening, he discovered that his time was slightly better than it had been before.
I still need transportation. I'll get it. It's your decision if any or all of you are alive at that time. Fuck off! How sad it is that what little of the English language remaining to you has devolved to this.
What the hell did he say?
Let's do it then.
Ivan started to draw. Ivan was falling down dead, his eyes wide open in startlement evolving to death, a wartime German service weapon falling from his fingers. The man at the bar fell in the same instant, his Beretta flying from his hand. The 2 men flanking Ivan went down. One had a homemade pipe shotgun already in his hands, and the other was struggling with something inside his clothing that looked like a zip gun.
Wait up!
There were 4 men running for the front door, and Rourke let them go. The last man in the room dove behind his table, and with the scoremaster in his right hand, Rourke lobbed a solitary round toward him. It was nearly empty anyway. Rourke thumbed up the safety, stepping back, and left as the man behind the table punched a German service pistol toward him. The Metalife Custom 629 Smith was in Rourke's right hand now. Rourke turned halfway toward the front doorway, just in case the four men who had fled returned. Marianne knelt speechless beside Ivan's body, hands clasped over her ears, tears streaming down her dirty cheeks. There was a small back door at the far end of the bar, which Rourke had noticed earlier, and it opened now. Natalia came through the doorway, her assault rifle in her hands.
Did you fire a shot?
Wolves are around here. I had to kill one.
Yeah, me too.
Gunther Hong started the interactive digitized display into motion, stopping it occasionally to make a comment, using a light pen to manipulate images. It was a map of the Western Hemisphere, its easternmost point, the Brazilian coastal re-entrant into the South Atlantic, its westernmost point, the Hawaiian Islands. There were targets marked on the map. Michael Rourke recognized most of them, and he presumed Martin Zimmer would recognize all of them. The charade was wearing thin, but to attempt to leave Gunther Hong's briefing to the staff, officers, both Eden forces and Nazi, although not uniformed, and some civilians as well, would be a dead giveaway. The Nazis were obvious, however, both by the swastika-emblazoned party pins in the collars of their turtleneck sweaters and their undeniable military bearing. The intelligence data Michael could collect here might prove invaluable.
The one problem area...
Hung worked some knobs on the control panel.
...is here.
The Hawaiian Islands expanded across the screen, filling it. The light pen touched at Oahu, over near New Honolulu.
The United States fleet. Midwake, as we know, was able to utilize the basic Soviet submarine designs of better than 100 years ago and improve on them. The reluctant craft are capable of high-speed underwater and surface navigation, with aircraft and missile launching capabilities. Some of those missiles have recently been armed with nuclear warheads. We have to knock out Pearl Harbor totally before we strike at our other targets.
Michael Rourke didn't know whether to laugh or to cry. If Admiral Yamamoto had suddenly walked into the underground briefing complex, Michael wouldn't have been surprised.
Pearl Harbor is on a low-level alert status and has been for several months. Which means, of course, they'll be a little sloppy about it by now. Before we strike, we intend to soften them up a little bit. Gruppenführer Kronberg will fill us in from here.
Kronberg. In the first instant, Michael entered the room beside Gunther Hong. His eyes were drawn to the man. Kronberg somehow seemed to exude intelligence, discipline, competence, and evil.
To recap, gentlemen, the National Socialist Movement has placed agents in key positions within the Hawaiian chain over the last 2 years. Our agents report that they are ready to undertake their assigned tasks when the order is given for them to do so.
With the light pen moving over the console's monitor, its motions repeated on the screen, which filled a third of the area of the far wall, he pointed to various locations one after the other.
At the designated moment, such acts of sabotage will be committed as to produce long-term disruption of power and communications facilities, defense sensing and imaging installations, etc. And of course, once our agents are away, preset biocharges will detonate. The result should be temporary decapacitation of nearly 90% of the island's population, including those military personnel not operating within a hermetically sealed environment. Controlled EMPs will be executed over Pearl Harbor itself.
And EMP, Michael knew, was an electromagnetic pulse derived from a nuclear explosion.
We will be utilizing low-yield devices, of course. Specially trained and equipped SS units will then depart Staging Area Alpha here on Molokai.
The image shifted on the screen so rapidly that watching it was almost nausea-inducing.
They will seize control of their respective areas, and barring the unforeseen, Pearl Harbor and an estimated 67% of the American naval fleet will be under our complete control. Those vessels affected by the EMPs, ones well out at sea, I should add, will be powerless to resist once our forces are in place. Only vessels in deep water will be operational, and that will comprise a minuscule percentage of the whole. Individual commanders refusing to surrender could be neutralized easily.
There was silence, and everyone looked at him. Michael Rourke realized it was suddenly incumbent upon him to speak, but the slightest error could cost him his life. Carefully, he composed and asked his question.
The likelihood of having to neutralize these independent commands, what is it?
The Americans are strong-willed. Our best estimates are that more than 90% of those who were operational would resist, either by attempting to launch a counterattack on their own initiative, or by fleeing to Midwake.
Michael Rourke merely nodded. Paul Rubinstein climbed the only high outcropping of rock within sight. Doing so got him some 20 feet above the plane. Using a pair of German field glasses, he looked first toward the Rift Valley. Along the horizon line to the east, he saw no spotter or attack aircraft. But as he intensified his focus and turned his glasses to the south, he saw a snow trail, the sort that would be made by a vehicle moving at reasonably good speed. He watched it for almost a minute. Its vector was taking whatever made it straight toward their position. Paul Rubenstein cased the field glasses and carefully, lest he slip on the rock face, started down. They would have to move, and quickly, too. Marianne had called him a murderer. If he lived to be 1,000 years old, John Rourke would never understand why or how a woman could love someone who treated her with such obvious contempt. And apparently, Marianne had loved her old man very much. When the three of them entered the stable, they found 12 horses and an equal number of crude saddles and attendant tack.
Why don't we do as planned, John? One of us goes for help while the other takes the rest of the horses back for Annie and Paul.
Now, there aren't enough horses anyway, so the loss of one more won't matter. You link up with Hilda, Dan, and Margie. Take a spare animal with you just in case.
John, you're better on horseback than I could ever be. And you're going to tell me I'm lighter so the horse won't tire as easily. But you're still better, which makes your reaching help much more reliable a proposition.
If there were ever a person with the power of logical persuasion, it's you. All right, fine. What do we do with Marianne? We can't leave her here for those other three or whoever else is around to come back here and harm her.
I'll take her with me.
John Rourke nodded, starting across the stable floor and looking into each of the crudely carpentered stalls. None of the animals was outstanding, all of them seeming malnourished and mistreated. But the largest of the animals, about 15 hands, seemed satisfactory. He was a gray, and John Rourke was partial to that color in an animal, but he looked to be the strongest of the horses as well.
Okay, I'll take him and one other, that mare.
Rourke pointed to a smaller statured bay who looked like she might be a good runner.
And I'll take the best saddle.
There wasn't much to choose from in that regard. All of the saddles basically crude seats and nothing more. They were most reminiscent of poorly crafted copies of the saddles the German long-range mountain patrols of a century ago utilized, similar in design to the old United States Cavalry McClellans. With what appeared to be the most solid of the saddles selected, John Rourke set it aside, then began saddling the other animals that Natalia would be taking back to Annie and Paul and the women. There were not enough horses for everyone to mount, but resourceful use would still be of aid to the group. He looked at Marianne, standing in the middle of the stable floor, still weeping. John Thomas Rourke had the stirrups lengthened as much as he could, but they still weren't comfortable. His knees higher than he liked them, he swung his mount and looked back along the street running between the 7 buildings of the unnamed town. It was not the time to bury Marianne's old man or any of the others. Those of their weapons that might prove even modestly serviceable were with Natalia and Marianne now, the others sufficiently dismantled as to be inoperable. The three men who had run still worried him a little, but there was no time to do anything about them. Holding the reins for the second animal, John Rourke dug his heels into the gray, urging the beast ahead to the north. With the injured woman on a litter between Paul and Martin Zimmer, Annie Rourke Rubenstein urged the 22 other women onward.
If you don't hurry, they'll catch up with us, and some of you could be killed, and the rest of you will be returned to the land pirates. So hurry!
Annie felt like someone's mother, warning a poorly behaved child to be good lest the boogeyman come.
We was better off with them, the land pirates.
Annie didn't know what to say in reply. Martin Zimmer's balcony looked out from Eden City's highest tower, over the city itself and the vast expanse of Georgia that lay toward the north. The atmosphere was richer now than it had been a century and a quarter ago, largely due, of course, to German-led efforts in regreening the South American rainforest lands. And although the population of the Earth had doubled and redoubled many times over, there was still comparatively little industry, and the air was very clean. The result was, as the sun began to set, that Michael Rourke could see so far into the distance he could almost fantasize seeing the mountain where the retreat, the only home he had ever really known, was located. He knew that was physically impossible, however. But a thought of home, even though that home was now a museum controlled by enemy forces who wished to kill him and his entire family, was still of comfort, however ephemeral. And he thought specifically of Natalia. His father had taken the news of his and Natalia's liaison so well, it was almost scary. But his father was, after all, John Rourke. Natalia. To lose Natalia was something of such devastating import, Michael Rourke could not comprehend it, nor did he try. Perhaps John Rourke had never thought of Natalia in that way, never considered her his woman. Therefore what? Michael Rourke missed Natalia more than he could ever have thought possible after the death of his wife, Madison. He would never see Natalia or anyone he loved again if he did not get out of here. Michael assessed the situation. He was still being viewed as Martin Zimmer. That would not last. He had the uncomfortable feeling that Kronberg, the SS Major General, already saw through him. If Dietrich Zimmer were to suddenly arrive, that would be it. To get away from the building, he could overpower a guard and steal a gun, or he could just walk out. After all, as Martin Zimmer, it was his building to command, as were the guards. And the information he had in his head concerning the impending attack on Pearl Harbor as a prelude to war was vital. That information had to be transmitted to Allied intelligence so the attack could be foiled and hopefully the war forestalled. Michael Rourke had the uncomfortable feeling that history was repeating itself, but at a much accelerated pace. A World War II-like beginning to what might be World War Last. James Darkwood walked alone along the street, the buildings surrounding him like towering mountain pinnacles. He had been born in Midwake, raised and schooled in the Hawaiian Islands, only returning to Midwake for the Naval Academy and his specialized naval intelligence training. A place like Eden, now the oldest surface city on Earth, still amazed him. There were a comparative few tall buildings in New Honolulu, but not this obsession for a terrestrially bound aggregation of synth concrete slabs to reach into the sky. He thrust his hands into his jacket pockets. He was alert to any sounds in the gathering darkness that might be at all out of the ordinary. His face was not known here in Eden City, nor was there any reason to suppose that anyone might take even the briefest second look at him, but he was still operating in enemy territory. There was considerable pressure exerted even at the Naval Academy for him to enter the submarine service. He was even offered a berth aboard the new Reagan. The United States nuclear submarine Ronald Wilson Reagan, Jason Darkwood's ship, was the most decorated vessel of the Midwake fleet. There were two submarines to bear the ship's name in the intervening 125 years, none of them, because it was peacetime, approaching her glorious record. This latest vessel, James Darkwood feared, might have the chance to prove itself, and quite soon. She was officially a submersible carrier vessel Navy. An aircraft carrier with the ability to operate above or below the surface like a spacecraft of the ocean, enormous, fast, and deadly if need be. If he ever became anything but a landlocked sailor, he'd love to serve aboard her. But uniform duty was a luxury he couldn't afford right now. The importance of on-the-ground intelligence gathering in these dark days could not be measured. And although he was only a small part of a large operation, each fragment of information acquired had the potential to be a breakthrough. War was coming. If the when and where of it could be determined, its toll might be less telling. As he rounded the corner, he saw a tall, almost impossibly long-legged silhouette against the lights of the early evening traffic. It belonged to Manfred Kohl, his partner for the last 2 years.
James!
Manfred, so?
Martin's in there. Has to be. I saw the usual motorcycle escorts, everything. Went in through the underground garage. That means our friends did not make it.
You're jumping to conclusions, Manfred.
Why am I jumping to conclusions, James?
Well, for one thing, we've never been able to tell for certain that those motorcycle escorts really are for Martin. And we don't know what Martin looks like. Only a handful of his people do. And even if Martin did come back, that doesn't mean the Rourke family failed in its mission or got caught. It only means Martin wasn't there. Maybe. You're a worrier, pal.
Perhaps.
Darkwood watched the building. It was the tallest in Eden City. From the outside, no one would have suspected it was the actual seat of government. The Capitol, two blocks away, was a quaint structure, centuries old in appearance. Few persons knew that a tunnel, traversed only by high-speed battery-powered cars, connected the two structures. He agreed with Manfred Kohl. The motorcycle escorts seen from time to time had to be for Martin, and maybe something had gone wrong for the Rourkes. Tall, lean, shaven head, the skin so tight over his skull that the veins could be seen pulsing, Kronberg stood in the doorway, right hand in the pocket of his jacket. Michael Rourke looked at him for an instant longer.
What is it?
I had hoped that I could speak with you, Martin.
I am tired. As you know, I started the day rather poorly.
It'll only take a moment.
Kronberg smiled. Michael Rourke didn't like the smile because it reminded him of a death mask.
All right.
Michael stepped aside, and Kronberg walked in. Michael was alone with him. Gunther Hong was presumably following orders and actually taking to the field to assist in the search for the Rourke family, which Michael prayed would be abortive. Michael had dismissed the uniformed manservant shortly after Hong left, needing to be alone, or as alone as he could be. Kronberg crossed the room, unbidden, and stopped just inside the balcony doors.
The view from here is incredible.
I suppose.
And Kronberg turned around, his hand out of his pocket and a gun about the size of Natalia's Walther PPKS pointing directly at Michael's center of mass.
Who are you?
Michael looked away from the solitary orifice of the gun and into the two orifices that were Kronberg's deep-set gray-blue eyes.
I could have you killed for this.
Ich habe sie nun jetzt. Sie albern amassend Bastard.
Michael recognized just enough of the vocabulary to realize the jig was up.
You really look like him, you know. Are you John Rourke?
You flatter me. I'm Michael Rourke, John Rourke's other son. I'm 500 years older than my brother Martin, but still, there's a marvelous resemblance.
You are very bold, and intelligent too, I think. Since these remarks will never leave this room, I will speak freely. More intelligent, I think, than your younger brother,
Nice of you to notice.
Where is he?
Are you trying to give me the impression that you don't like old Marty?
Marty! Ah, Marty! Well, as a matter of fact, Herr Rourke, I do not like him one bit. He's an annoying little...
Are you searching for the word prick, Kronberg?
Yes, a prick. Now, if you would step over to the balcony and take in that lovely view for one last time, please.
Michael didn't move.
Are you planning to kill me and make it appear that Martin's dead?
The thought had crossed my mind, yes. You see, I have always believed that the true test of genius is the ability to take advantage of opportunity, then capitalize on the present rather than vainly plan for a future which may never come.
Aside from the fact that you're a Nazi, and that Nazis are assholes, of course.
Kronberg's eyes hardened, and his fist balled a bit more tightly around his gun.
I find you quite engaging. And your philosophy concerning seizing the moment is something with which I wholeheartedly agree. Carpe diem.
Yes, the dead language. Latin. How appropriate for a man who is soon to be dead to use the dead language. To the balcony, please.
Michael sat where he was.
You don't want me shot. You want me splattered all over the sidewalk.
Actually, I would more suppose you will be splattered, as you put it, all over the street. Science and mathematics seem to suggest to me that the fall would pull you slightly outward. But shall we experiment? You'll know a split second before I do.
You can always go first, if you like.
I find your wit rather engaging as well. And you are correct, of course, that if I shoot you, my ends will not be so well served as if you merely die from impact. But I will shoot you if I must. Think of it this way, Herr Rourke. If you walk toward the balcony, perhaps you can attempt to disarm me. Perhaps even succeed. Otherwise, I must merely pull the trigger.
Best to squeeze, as I'm sure you know. More accurate shot placement. Don't you think Dietrich Zimmer will be able to tell from the remains that it isn't Martin, but someone else instead?
Oh, he would indeed be able to tell. But by the time he arrives, which will not be until several hours have passed, I will have succeeded in beginning a process that not even Dietrich Zimmer will be able to stop.
I know. A coup, right?
As a matter of fact, yes. You guessed it, Herr Rourke. Congratulations.
I don't understand. You're all Nazis, and you all want to start a war to take over the world, and the only way to defeat the Trans-Global Alliance is to go nuclear.
I think we have talked sufficiently, Herr Rourke.
Michael stood up.
You think you can do better, and now you don't want to worry about Martin Zimmer when it's all through, right?
Something like that.
Michael started walking.
You still want to hit Pearl Harbor, just like the Japanese did in 1941?
Not actually quite like that. They lost their war. We will not. And we wish to avail ourselves of the United States fleet, not send it to the bottom.
Michael stopped, looking Kronberg straight in the eye. They were dead even now.
Bottom? Whose?
There was a moment's look of incomprehension in Kronberg's eyes. That was the same moment Michael Rourke chose to throw himself toward the Nazi, his left hand trying to sweep the gun away from the plane of his body. That was not entirely successful. The night sky, black as velvet, textured with stars, was magnificently clear. John Rourke navigated by the stars as he rode north. To maximize on the ability of the horses, he planned to stop for 10 minutes every hour, rubbing the animals down and switching mounts. He rode the bay mare now, and she was a good runner. The countryside rolled gently here and was more normal in appearance. Tree cover in broad, deep stands. At the rise, where he now paused, he shifted his gaze to the south, seeing the lights behind him again. They were torches. There seemed to be more than a dozen of them, moving at about his own pace. He now knew at least part of the story of the men who had fled the gunfight in the bar. The torches could be from no source other than a horse posse, and for no other purpose than to read the ground for the prints of his horses. These men lived in the wildlands, of course, and reading sign would be as much a part of life as reading a street sign had been more than 6 centuries ago. But there was nothing to say that these men were good at reading sign. Someone really good at it wouldn't have needed torches on such a clear night. The time was not yet right, however. John Rourke urged his mount ahead, down the slope and into the shallow, dish-shaped valley beyond, ever northward. Michael Rourke's left side burned, and the smell on the air was from his own flesh. As he rolled from Kronberg, the Nazi was up instantly to his feet, but Kronberg's right hand was limp, and the gun was gone from his grasp. Michael Rourke, his left side paining him badly enough that there were floaters across his eyes, drew his feet under him and threw himself toward Kronberg's groin. Michael fell back. As Kronberg sprang toward him, Michael Rourke's right leg snapped forward and upward, the toe of Martin Zimmer's boot catching the Nazi just under the jaw. Michael Rourke reached for the pistol that had fallen to the floor. He had it, then threw himself onto Kronberg, cracking the pistol down across the gleaming, pinkish flesh of the Nazi's skull. Michael held the pistol's muzzle to Kronberg's temple, then felt for a pulse. There was one, very strong still from the exertion of the fight, and the air passage seemed clear, Kronberg's breathing shallow but regular.
Don't want you dead, pal.
If all Michael's own efforts and those of the family should fail, Martin Zimmer's hold on the Eden government would be in jeopardy while Kronberg lived, and one less SS officer would not win or lose a war. Michael leaned back, organizing his thoughts. There was not very much time. The shot could have been heard, and if Dietrich Zimmer were coming soon, there was much to do. He thought about his mother, lying near death. Get Dietrich Zimmer to save her, then kill the man very dead for what he had done before. Her Detonic Scoremaster was in her right hand. The hammer cocked, the safety off, and her finger on the trigger. The muzzle was about an inch away from Martin's crotch.
You would not really shoot your own brother, would you?
I always wanted a baby sister.
Annie jabbed the muzzle against his testicles. The smile that had started forming in his eyes vanished. He really believed her. She could see past him through the slit where the rain poncho, which was mounded over with snow, and the actual ground met. There were two vehicles, both of them heavily armored personnel carriers, fully tracked and moving very rapidly. Hiding beneath the snow was all they could do, and even at that, heat-sensing equipment might find them through body temperature alone. The women were to her immediate right in groups of two, probably freezing even more than she was. Paul and the woman in the stretcher were to her left, their positions forming a crescent along what was anticipated to be the least likely path for the vehicles to take. Both vehicles flew small Nazi flags from their hatchways.
When my people find you, sister dear, I shall personally delight in your slow and painful death.
Oh, gee, Martin. I bet you would have twisted the heads off my Barbie dolls too, huh? Shut up! And yes, I know if I fire this pistol, your boys will hear it and we're in deep trouble. Maybe Dietrich Zimmer's such a hot-shot surgeon, he can put your testicles back together. Go ahead, and let's try.
How our father must admire you, sister dear. You're tough like a man.
Sex doesn't matter when it comes to believing in what's right, Martin. What's right is right. But the man who raised you preferred to raise you on a pack of lies. You wondered if I'd really pull the trigger? I would. And Daddy is proud of me, and so's my husband.
The Jew, yes.
She didn't say anything, because if she kept at it, and Martin kept at it too, maybe she really would blow his manhood away. In many respects, James Darkwood had always considered himself quite a bit like his illustrious ancestor, Jason Darkwood, the fondness for antiques a common trait. On those occasions when he had to carry a gun, to be found as a civilian in Eden in possession of a firearm was punishable, sometimes by death, he favored a cartridge arm to the more modern handheld energy devices. There was a firm in Hawaii that still made such firearms. To this day, such guns were quite popular among target shooters and purists in New Germany, according to articles he'd read in magazines devoted to guns and shooting. He reached under his coat to that cartridge arm now. The gun was very nearly as old a design as one could find that still fired a fixed round. Yet it was one of the best.
That man exiting the building. It's either John Rourke or Michael Rourke. And look at the way he's holding his side, Manfred.
The guard is coming after him.
James Darkwood nodded, saying nothing. He had the gun out. It was a nearly identical duplicate of the classic Colt Browning Model 1911A1, but with similar design modifications to those incorporated into the Detonix 45s carried by John Rourke. Like those guns and the later Colts, one of Darkwood's hobbies was arms history, this gun was in stainless steel. And Darkwood doubly trusted the firm that made it, Lancer. Lancer was the company that designed and produced the 9mm caseless Lancer 2418A2 pistol, which saw considerable use in the closing years of the war. Jason Darkwood had carried one of those into battle. Only 7 rounds to a magazine, those 7 rounds were 185-grain jacketed hollow points, the bullet nearly twice the weight of more commonly encountered handgun projectiles in those relatively few handguns that even fired projectiles in this day of energy weapons. The loads were duplicates of those Dr. Rourke had used and still did use in his own guns, as originally made by Federal Cartridge during the 20th century. At all times, Darkwood carried at least 2 spare magazines for his Lancer 45 ACP. Should a situation arise beyond 22 rounds being sufficient, he was in trouble. But he didn't walk into such a situation by choice. If a firefight should loom, he would take an energy rifle. Going to a gunfight by choice was stupid enough, but going to one by choice armed with only a handgun was insane. Hawaiian-based Lancer produced various antique firearms from the 19th and 20th centuries, all handcrafted, many of them meticulous duplicates of other guns of Dr. Rourke's, together with the appropriate ammunition. The 45 was in his hand, his thumb poised over the hammer as he started across the street. Manfred Cole had his weapon out as well, just under his coat. Darkwood's gun was beside his right thigh as he cocked the hammer.
Say, excuse me. Hi, I'm a little lost, I think, and,
Fuck off!
Whichever Rourke it was, walking slightly bent over and in obvious pain, he looked more like Michael Rourke the closer James Darkwood got, turned around and looked to the guard.
Return to your post. That is an order.
James Darkwood didn't know what was going on at all, but in his business, that was nothing unusual. Natalia Tiamarovna reined in her mount.
Stop your horse, Marianne!
The girl's one admirable quality, under these circumstances at least, was her quickness to obey, but Natalia felt a growing concern for her as a person. Marianne was so used to being abused that she had forgotten, it seemed, how to assert herself as a woman, had she ever known at all. But now Natalia's attention was drawn to one thing only, the immediate crisis. 2 heavily tracked vehicles were just coming over a low rise. If the occupants had not already picked up 2 mounted riders and the additional horses, visually or with sensing equipment, they would in an instant. Natalia stood in her stirrups. There was a defile to the north.
Come on, hurry, Marianne.
Natalia wrapped her right hand more tightly in the lead rope for the 4 mounts she led.
Bring the horses, don't lose them!
Natalia looked back. Marianne was turning her horse toward the defile. The 4 horses she led were struggling to be free. Natalia made an instant decision. She drew in the reins of her own animal, and as Marianne struggled past, shifted the lead of the 4 horses to her left hand, holding that and the reins of her mount as well. Natalia reached for the balisong. Her right arm was already arcing downward, severing the lead rope to the 4 animals Marianne had in tow.
Run for it!
Marianne's horse vaulted ahead through the snow toward the defile. Natalia already had her knife closed, pouching it. She glanced once toward the armored personnel carriers. A swastika banner was visible on the nearer of the 2 machines.
Damn!
With any luck, sensors or visual observation from the APCs would pick up the 4 loose horses and nothing else. With any luck. Michael Rourke had Kronberg's little pistol in his right hand. As the guard from the entrance to the high-rise started to swing his assault rifle forward toward James Darkwood and Manfred Cole, Michael put the muzzle of the pistol to the man's head.
Unlike an energy weapon, even a little one like this will punch a hole right through the side of your head.
The guard lowered his weapon. Manfred Cole, a gun in his right hand, pushed the Eden Defense Forces trooper into the alley. James Darkwood reached for Michael.
You look like shit.
Glad somebody noticed.
Michael Rourke almost started to laugh, but the pain in his side was too intense for that. The horseman who pursued him by torchlight rode relentlessly across the snow. Although John Rourke was easily able to stay ahead of them because he had planned ahead and brought a spare mount, at the pace he had to push both animals, there was no time for resting. At this rate, the horses would be played out in another few hours, as would those ridden by the posse, their mounts probably sooner. But the fact remained that without a horse, John Rourke knew he would not reach the rendezvous point with the agents from Allied Intelligence. Therefore, aside from his own predicament, Paul and Annie and Natalia would be stranded with Martin Zimmer and the women, one of whom couldn't even walk. This side of the Rift Valley, although sparsely populated, seemed to be a dangerous place. The people here whom he had met, constantly on the defensive against the attacks of the land pirates, had sunk to the level of their enemies. Marianne had clearly been mentally abused before falling victim to the land pirates, and John Rourke somehow doubted she was atypical. Few of the women he and the others had rescued from the fortress of the land pirates seemed to possess anything of culture or even civility. All seemed worn beyond their years. Transformations such as that did not come about overnight. John Rourke had rested his mounts as long as he dared now. He climbed aboard the Grey. The animals seemed little better cared for than the women around here, and both the Grey and the little mare were starting to show signs of fatigue. The cold, intense with the night, didn't help matters. In his mind, he was constructing a contingency plan to alleviate the deteriorating situation. The safe house was indeed a house. How safe it was remained to be seen. It was one of the homes built better than 50 years ago when Eden had gone through a single-family housing boom. Deep within Eden City itself, it was now substandard and most of the houses in the area were abandoned. There was no electricity. Synth-fuel lamps burned at either end of the table. There was no glass in the windows anywhere, the openings boarded over. But blankets, by contrast new-looking, were hung inside to prevent any light from showing. 6 centuries ago, the area would have been called a slum. Michael Rourke had read about such places. Now he was experiencing it.
Pearl Harbor.
Michael nodded his head. Cole was trained as a medic and set about cleaning the wound on Michael's side.
This is not too bad, Michael. A little rest and taking it easy for a while, you should be fine.
You gotta get people alerted to what's happening, but first you have to send out some sort of a rescue party.
Michael had refused any sort of painkiller while Cole worked on his wound. The risk of dulling his senses now could spell disaster in more ways than he could calculate.
Are you sure they weren't aware of who you were, Michael? And this Martin guy is really your brother?
Michael looked squarely at Darkwood.
Martin Zimmer is some sort of product of Dietrich Zimmer. He has to be. Whether it's the way Martin was raised, or there was some genetic tampering, or I don't know. But the point is, Cronenberg wouldn't have come to kill me himself if anybody else had known. He was banking on the idea that I'd at least temporarily be mistaken for Martin Zimmer, long enough for him and his people to—
You mean Cronenberg and his cronies?
You laugh. Fine. But Cronenberg wants the power for himself and his faction. But none of that is important now. The deal about an attack on Pearl Harbor was real. Cronenberg can't substantially change the plans without a reason. What's he gonna say?
Very well say that he knew you weren't Martin and tried to kill you so he could organize a coup. And if he figures something may have happened to Martin, Cronenberg's better off not saying anything about what happened. Or anything more than he has to in order to cover for the fight you two had. You're right. If the Pearl Harbor thing is really on, there may be some minor detail changes. He could get away with that. He might even move up the timetable. But he can't cancel it out.
Get some people out after my dad, Natalia, and everybody. We get Dad, he'll know what to do.
Getting a rescue party up is not that easy. Getting over the Rift Valley is dangerous. Unless we fly so high that we will be picked up on Eden's defense radars and get shot down anyway. We have to keep very low. That means that a storm over the valley can destroy us.
Michael Rourke was trying to think. There had to be a way.
I think I know how we can handle this. If HQ approves it, it'll work and expedite the whole thing.
What's your headquarters have to approve?
An incursion on Eden soil. Technically, at least, the entire continental United States, with the exception of Alaska, is an Eden protectorate, even though west of the Rift Valley isn't part of Eden itself. We've got submarines off the west coast. One of the patrol sectors covers from what used to be Chihuahua up along Arizona to as far north as Reno Harbor. If I can get a commando team flown in, they can locate your family, evacuate them and the women, then fly your father and the rest of them right out to Pearl.
Then do it. Some of those women will need medical attention. And you're going to have to find a safe place to stash Martin Zimmer. We need him for our own reasons.
You stay with Michael. I will get out of the city and make the satellite uplink.
We'll all go. Then get out of Eden City and find some transportation to Pearl Harbor.
You should not be moving about.
I should not be living in this century either, should I?
Natalia lay in the snow, the stock of her short-barreled assault rifle extended and snug against her shoulder. The weapon would be useless against the armored personnel carriers, of course, but not against the occupants, should they emerge. The two tracked vehicles had stopped some time ago, near the hoofprints. Lights played over the snow, but that was all. Marianne lay beside her.
If we give up, they won't murder us. They'll want to fuck us, and then we'll be all right.
Natalia looked at her, stunned.
When the land pirates hit us, they killed a whole lot. Me, I figures what'll work, and it does. When they breaks in where I hid, I ripped open my dress and let them see my tits. Then I says, who wants a blow? And
despite the possibility that the sound would be heard, Natalia slapped the girl hard across the face.
Listen to me, Marianne. Sex is something two people have because both people want it, not something a woman does to make an excuse for her to be kept alive. We're not surrendering to the men in those armored personnel carriers, and they won't take us without a fight. And if they take us, the only way they'll take us in the way you are talking about is to kill us or drag us so we're unconscious. Some men enjoy sex that way. It's called necrophilia, but most men don't. If you try anything else, I will kill you. Because you would be better off dead with self-respect than being alive without it. Is that clear?
Tears streamed down Marianne's cheeks, one redder than the other where Natalia had slapped it. But Marianne nodded. Paul Rubinstein moved through the snow on knees and elbows, the Schmeisser in both hands just forward of his jaw. He was near the height of the rise and did not want to risk silhouetting himself there and attracting attention. But he had to make certain that the armored personnel carriers had moved on far enough ahead to get the women out of hiding in the snow before they froze to death. But in the next instant, his ears confirmed what his eyes could not yet see. The APCs were near. Finally attaining the height of the rise, he kept his head very low, furrowing out a narrow channel in a ridge of hard-packed snow so he could see. The machines had stopped. Powerful lights played over the ground where there were markings along the way. Paul pushed his submachine gun onto his back, then uncased the German binoculars. They had vision intensification capabilities, and he used that now, careful to avoid looking directly into one of the lights and temporarily blinding himself. Instead, he focused on the markings in the snow. As a kid growing up on Air Force bases, it wasn't the sort of thing he'd exactly seen every day. But since the night of the war, he'd learned a lot of things. And this was one of the simplest. The markings in the snow were horses' hoof prints. There was nothing to suggest that bands of wild horses lived in this barren snow country. That meant that John and Natalia and that crazy girl Marianne had made them. And either John or Natalia was out there somewhere on the way back with help. Paul Rubinstein put down his glasses and waited. There was nothing else he could do. He had given away most of his warm clothing to the women and wore only a heavy woolen sweater over his thermal shirt. John Thomas Rourke, his body shaking with the cold, lay in the snow. He suffered from a lack of appropriate equipment. The German assault rifle, firing a caseless cartridge and due for phase-out over the latest energy rifle, was decent, but not the sort of thing that he liked for a sniping situation. The cartridge was less a potential man-stopper than the 5.56mm round used in his CAR-15 and similar AR-15 M16 weapon systems. And it went against his grain for him to enter into a sniping situation with the necessity to burst fire. Yet he could not trust one solitary round to do the job of nailing a man wearing heavy winter gear. The rifle did not meet the terrain and situation requirements. His alternatives to the rifle were less than satisfactory. There were nine men in the party. Although the quality of the arms they carried could not be vouched for, the abundance of them was obvious through his binoculars. Indeed, so much less than satisfactory were his alternatives that they ceased to exist. John Rourke brought the rifle to his shoulder. It didn't have the feel of the Steyr-Mannlicher SSG, nor even that of his CAR-15 or an ordinary M16. The stock, a bullpup type, was ideal for close-range maneuverability, but less than ideal for precision riflery. And John Rourke suddenly wondered if he were becoming an anachronism. He lived in a world so far removed from his own time that the only things about it which seemed at all familiar were brutality, greed, and the occasional incident of human nobility. If he could save Sarah somehow, he had never realized how much he loved her until she was gone. His desire for Natalia, it was love, genuine enough, was not what he felt for his wife. He desired Sarah, he loved Sarah, and unlike Natalia, Sarah was a part of him, and he was a part of her too. If, he wanted to believe in when, but if he could bring her back, he would go with her someplace and start all over again, leaving this behind them. He had fought for longer than any man had ever fought, and he was tired of fighting. Peace on Earth would only be achieved when man was absent from the Earth. Perhaps he was becoming a cynic, but at least he was being honest with himself. As long as one man had something another did not, there would be strife. To make all men totally, absolutely equal, the dream of Marxists and utopians and others since the beginning of the modern era, and likely well earlier than that, was impossible, except when gauged by the lowest common denominator. All men could be poor. All men could be without property or substance. All men could be denied the most basic of human freedoms. All men could be slaves. And that was the only way. Equality under the law and equality in fact were two entirely different matters. All men were, in fact, created equal. They became what they became, some good and some bad. But most were somewhere between the two opposite poles of morality, most little concerned with anything outside their own immediate sphere. People were and always would be, as long as they were people, ready to kill. The immediate now was as fine an example of that truth as he could have conceived of. His life was more valuable to him than the lives of the 9 men who pursued him. His life was valuable to him not only because of his desire to continue living, but also because hinged upon his survival were the lives of several people he loved. Toward the end of living for himself and for those he loved, he had now to take something that only God could return in the hereafter. He'd taken many lives, and as long as he lived, he would likely be forced to continue the practice. What was wrong with the world was definitely the infestation that lived upon it.
Oh, shit. Bitter, John Rourke.
There was no response. He already knew the answer, and the night ignored him. Through the little integral scope on the rifle's carrying handle, he watched the first man he would shoot. He could not see the face clearly. That was good.